Ghosts in the Attic, Bodies in the Basement is a paranormal true crime podcast.
If you enjoy tales of horror, lore, and the unexplained,
murders, mystery, and so much more,
tune into our bi-weekly podcast.
With us, your hosts, Anna Temperley
and Lindsay Behe, coming March 17th
through the Fearscape Media Podcast Network.
Available on Apple, Stitcher, Spotify, and wherever else you may listen to your podcasts.
There is no question that something is here, lurking somewhere in the darkened corners. But how will we ever find out what it is? We need to look, always, and never stop. No matter what stands in our way, no matter what others may think. Explore the darkness. Shine light into it. Join the red strings and the silver threads. Everything is connected, somehow. I am Mark L. Watson. This is Peer Beyond the Veil.
I came out of the womb with a pad and a pen writing stories. I mean, I think I've been told that as early as I could talk, I was telling stories. And I, around the age of four, thought that Bigfoot lived in the woods behind our house. And I was into aliens and UFOs, which I think was because my father, who was a geophysicist, had a secret passion for UFOs and the paranormal. And I just remember it always being present. I don't think I've had any direct experiences as a child, but, you know, who knows? But I was always writing. I was always telling stories. I was always out in nature, observing things and writing them down on my little notebooks. And I had like this book bag filled with feathers, and I was a bird watcher, and I'd collect stones and I would identify them, and just one of those really weird kids. I spent a lot of time alone and I was an avid reader. We'd go to the library because this was quite a while ago during the era of the dinosaurs, and I would take out just a stack of books, read them, you know, about a week later back, swap them out for more. So my mom was always really creative and still is. So I got the creativity angle from my mom, and I got my love of science from my dad, but also along with that, because he was very open-minded about there being an unseen reality. And he, you know, as a physicist, I think I got all that stuff from him. And what was really weird is I have a very distinct memory of being about 7 years old. And my father, again, a geophysicist, was sitting around our little kitchen table. This was in New York, where I grew up, with his colleagues who were geologists, astrophysicists, an oceanographer. And they were talking about UFOs. And here I am sort of sitting under the table, like listening. And later on, it occurred to me how unusual that was, that, you know, this group of scientists would be talking about something like that. And we would talk about it all the time. And he would say, oh, you'd be surprised how many scientists really believe in, or not necessarily believe in, but are very interested in ghosts and UFOs and all of this stuff, but they can't really talk about it. You know, they have to kind of keep it on the down low or in the part of their personal lives. And so that was always really funny. And years later, he and I wrote a book together about supervolcanoes based on a theory that he had come up with. And that was really, really cool. But I just have such a, you know, profound memory of him, of that realization that science and the paranormal were like two ends of the same yardstick, but they were both kind of describing reality, but in different ways.
Whilst often shied away from, shunned, or even mocked, a belief in the existence of another realm of consciousness is significantly more widespread than we often acknowledge. Many of us are followers of a religion who believe that there is an omnipresent God or an afterlife associated with it, who say prayer at altars to beings unseen. Others are of a spiritual nature, in tune with the natural order. Along the line, there are those who believe in things such as fate and destiny, that the universe plays some quiet, backseat role in your life and your place here. Others believe clearly in life after death, in ghosts, in all manner of spectral entities, and then, of course, in extraterrestrial life, ultra-terrestrial existences, and the power of mind over matter. It's thought that around 84% of the world's population classify themselves as being religious, or followers of a religion. Of the remaining 16% or so, it's safe to say that many would fall into the categories I describe above. What you're left with is a picture of a global population whose belief system is structured around the notion that we're not alone. Whilst many would not regard it as important, it is for others still somewhat needed to try to verify a little of this with science, itself an ever-changing thing. Studies and findings replace those which came before them, beliefs change and adapt to changing circumstances, and we slowly move our knowledge base onwards and upwards. The issue, of course, is that things like expanded consciousness, religious existence, and life after death are largely unable to be proved one way or the other by current scientific methods. Indeed, the very concept of these things may only exist within the conscious itself. But we'll get there. And we'll get there because of the work done by the pioneers of study. Each takes a subject, or indeed many, and climb on to the shoulders of giants who walked before them, slowly reaching closer to the light. Described by New York Times best-selling author Jim Mars for her work on quantum physics and new science as having joined a list of forward-thinking individuals who are taking us to the next level in both science and our understanding of the universe and our place in it, it is with great pleasure that we welcome the fantastic Marie D. Jones to the show tonight. Marie's work in bridging science with the paranormal has earned her widespread acclaim across the communities of both, and she has a huge list of incredibly researched books and papers on topics of consciousness and the mind, conspiracy, propaganda, and mind control, mysteries of the human mind such as déjà vu and synchronicity, and a range of other metaphysical studies. Marie joins us to talk through her work and to share a little about how each of us, when we really think about it, we'll quite often peer beyond the veil.
I had always wanted to write about mind control, and I love a good conspiracy, and I always have. And I feel like where there's smoke, there's fire. So, you know, for me, it's always been about looking at a conspiracy and trying to find out what the truth might be behind it. But I'm trying to remember if the publisher New Page suggested it or not, because sometimes that will happen. The publisher will say, hey, you know, would you be interested in doing this? And I'll be like, yes. And then other times, like, you know, not really. But regardless, I was thrilled to be able to write it. At the time, I was working with a co-writer. I'm now writing alone. And it started out quite challenging because in order to write a book, you're having to go by page or word count. Now, with this subject matter, just mind control alone, let's take away surveillance and social engineering and media manipulation and just mind control alone could fill 10 books. And so it was really difficult to try to find a way to cram, 50 books into one book. So the decision was to try to make it a little bit introductory. Somebody who maybe had never read or heard about MKUltra or domestic surveillance or any of these interesting ways that we're being manipulated by social media and the news, blah, blah, blah. You know, how would you best present them with just sort of a primer? And that's kind of how we approached the book. So starting out with the history of it, because honestly, as long as humans have walked the earth, we have been trying to manipulate each other. And we have been trying back from the caveman days to control each other, whether it's the sexes trying to, you know, get what they want from each other, controlling each other's behaviors, finding ways to manipulate your enemies. And it's just such a part of human nature. And it's been around, you know, throughout ancient civilizations. Often they would use ritual as a way of mind control, because the act of ritual is so sacred that if you're not included in it, you don't know, you know, you're not part of what's going on. If you are included in it, you feel very obliged to play by the rules and to engage in that ritual. And that was really fascinating to look at. And then, of course, getting into more modern times and how it has been around, you know, since the before the 1950s, but a lot of the real documentation kind of started around that time, and how it's been used by our governments, not just the United States, by the military, experimenting on people, not telling them. The media, I think, is the biggest culprit, and certainly today in modern times, I think mass media is the biggest culprit, the biggest purveyors of mind control, you could say. So that's kind of how we sort of molded the book, looking at the history, but keeping it sort of introductory so that people could read it. And if they got really excited about a certain part of it, they could go do more. You know, we always have a good bibliography if people want to go research on their own. And I had literally for the last couple of years been begging that publisher to do, if I could do a follow-up, because so much has changed, especially with the emergence of social media. And they just, you know, they kept kind of dragging their feet. So I started working with another publisher, Visible Ink Press, and they allowed me to do a big encyclopedic book on propaganda, disinformation, and media, mass media, social engineering, cult mentality, you name it. And that'll be out in May. And I'm a little concerned because I'm not sure how it is for other countries, but here in the United States, anybody who writes about those things is being censored, banned, blocked, shadow banned, removed from, you know, social media.
But ironically, that in itself is a form of population mind control. So
it is. It's an admittance that is taking place, because they only censor what they don't want you to know, right? The truth. And yeah, it's an admittance of it, and it's a way for them to try to manipulate the narrative that you see on the nightly news, on your local news, on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, you name it. And what I have found is that when you present people with ways to identify propaganda, they suddenly cannot unsee it. They're able to immediately identify it. And that's when everything changes. So yeah, there's definitely a push to not allow that to happen. But hell, you know, I wrote the book that I wrote, and we'll see what happens. And that one's followed up with a book on toxins in our food and water and pharmaceuticals and things like that. And I have literally told people that if neither one of those books gets me killed or thrown in jail, it'll be a miracle. but it is. People, for a long time, if you say mind control, they thought you were an idiotic conspiracy theorist. And they have no idea that this is a very, it's very provable. There's documentation, there's declassified materials, and it's been around for a long time, and it still is. And I actually think it's getting worse. It's definitely shifted. One of the reasons why is that in here in the United States in 2013, then President Barack Obama passed an amendment to what was called the Smith-Mundt Act. And that act had banned domestic propaganda. In other words, you could use propaganda at that time when dealing with, you know, people in other countries and trying to sway their positions and their opinions, but you were not allowed to do it to your own people. So by repealing that act, it opened up the door for what became known as fake news. And now, having such an eye for it, I can tell you that the vast majority of what we see in our media and in social media is not real. A lot of it goes back to Operation Mockingbird, which was a CIA program that's been around for decades and is still underway. And that is to fully manipulate the public via the media. And now they have the social media to back that up.
So that's kind of vital. And that's why you say it's almost more a problem now than ever before, yeah, to a degree. That actually the ability to feed information into people isn't just a daily newspaper, a daily news bulletin, as it may have been back in the 50s and 60s. They all took in the news. Now everybody has the news, the social media in their hands. Some people every 5 minutes, they're looking at the screen. And so the ability, yep, to put information, or if you will, disinformation into people, mm-hmm, and to get the information back out so you know how much that's sticking and how to gauge what the reaction is to it, is as effective today as it has ever been.
Oh yeah, I think it's much more pervasive, and the people behind it, whether it's advertisers or the pharmaceutical industry or the war machine, whoever, they know that we are addicted to our phones, to our gadgets. We're addicted to checking social media every 5 minutes, and it's a manipulation of that addiction. And you know, the belief is that if you repeat something often enough, it doesn't matter how ridiculous it is, it will be accepted as truth. And so when you have billionaires that own these social media networks or sites or whatever you want to call it, that are all sort of, you know, part of the same end game, I guess you could say, they all benefit from being able to manipulate their users and their customers. And what they're doing is blocking. I mean, I was knocked off Facebook for months, and I have to be very careful what I say, because my goal is to sell books so you could read about all this stuff. So if I start, you know, mouthing off on Facebook and Twitter and what have you, and I get blocked, I have no way to get people to read the material that I've been researching and writing about. But I have watched hundreds of my colleagues, whether they are alternative voices politically in the natural health field, speaking out against the narratives with the pharmaceutical industry, whatever. People like Robert Kennedy Jr., even, I'm watching them getting shut down and banned and blocked, and there's lawsuits and lawsuits and lawsuits, and it's absolutely insane. I mean, the last time we had such a big push for propaganda was right after 9/11, terrorist attacks, when the Patriot Act was introduced here in the United States, which was rather draconian. And there needed to be that push to kind of get everybody to get on board. But I have never seen anything like what I have seen now in the COVID years with some of the manipulation that's going on. It's absolutely insane and kind of frightening. But when people when they read or learn the techniques, like I did, I mean, I was an idiot for a long time. Then you, like I said, you see it, you cannot unsee it. And once you know how you're being manipulated, you can't be manipulated again. And I think that is the biggest obstacle to what some of these organizations are trying to do. They know that if people catch on to the techniques that are being used, whether it's, you know, repetition or rhetoric or Hegelian dialect or us versus them thinking, whatever, that we're not going to be able to be manipulated as much anymore. And maybe we won't buy what they're selling.
Unfortunately, though, and this isn't, well, it is a very pessimistic way of looking at it, but I do see it as probably a realistic way of looking at it. They're relying on the fact that most people just won't look, or they might be presented with, they might listen to this episode, they might hear you speak, and they might think, oh, that's interesting. And then they'll just go back again. And they're relying on the fact that the masses will just follow behind.
I totally agree with you. Cognitive dissonance. And I remember, you know, one of the things that I sort of pride myself on is that I used to be on that side of the line, you know, that line that's drawn. And I remember believing certain things and people showing me facts against what I believed. And I just, no, I don't want to believe that. It doesn't compute, you know, that cognitive dissonance and the denial, because we think that what we believe is who we are. Our identities are locked into, I'm a Democrat, I'm a Republican, I'm a liberal, I'm a conservative, I'm this, I'm that, I'm atheist, I'm Catholic. And when somebody challenges those, you know, that those limitations, that sort of tunnel vision that we have, oh my Lord, you're right. And it is pessimistic, and I agree with you, but I am seeing sort of a trickle effect of people somehow finding the information that they need. And I was talking with a friend earlier today, you know, that there are things happening that you get to a certain point, it's like a tipping point, you can't deny it anymore. You know, it's like somebody hitting you with a board over and over and you're like, oh, it doesn't hurt. Well, at some point, yeah. It's going to hurt. It's going to make some blood come out. So I totally agree with what you said, but I do see strange ways that information is getting out. Sure. And people are like, what? Wait a minute. You know, with COVID, the CDC said this yesterday, but now they're saying this. But wait, if masks work, why do you need the vaccine? If you have the vaccine, now you need the mask. You know, it's like people are starting to kind of put two and two together and get seven, and yeah, it doesn't make sense. So you know, that's my take on it. But I think that is indicative of a lot of things, that the people with the money and the power are able to create a narrative, and anybody or anything that tries to say, you know, hold on, what about this here, are vilified.
So that was exactly what I was gonna kind of come to. Given the power and the stranglehold that big corporation, that the big tech firms, kind of that the government, though actually with a focus more on the power that the kind of big tech firms have on the ability to feed, drip feed, misfeed information in, certainly with a kind of highlight on, I don't like to bring his name into the show, but your former president, and the things that happened with regarding the kind of last few months of his presidency and the storming of the Capitol building, and then all mass media just turning him off, and the power that has. Given that situation that ultimately is the one that we now live in globally, do you see there being a way out, a positive way out?
The problem is that we sacrifice the one person, and I was not a Trump fan until I actually did my research, and he was actually trying to, you know, fight for America first here in the United States, no getting us into new wars and what have you. And now that we have the Democrats in full control here, we're back bombing Syria, and there are some even more severe restrictions coming. In fact, our COVID package that the Democrats passed today included allowing the Department of Justice to go ahead and censor social media, and that's fascism. So you'll hear a lot of people talk about
it's a dangerous precedent. It really is.
It, is. And the funny thing is that what I noticed and what kind of turned me around with Trump, I mean, he's a, you know, he's a boisterous, arrogant person, but what I began to see was here in the United States, the absolute tyrannical, fascist censoring of conservative voices. And I had been a liberal all my life. And seeing that, I actually, I had to leave the Democratic Party. I had to walk away. Because as a writer, I don't believe you censor anybody. You know, I'm now a proud independent because of that one thing. I watched, I might not agree with conservative voices, but they have every right to speak what they're talking about. And, you know, you mentioned the storming of the Capitol, and we have information coming out now showing how not everything that we were told happened actually happened the way we were told. And once again, we are left not really knowing the truth about anything because our media has to create and shape and push a particular narrative.
Sure.
And now, you know, here we are bombing Syria again, and the promises that were made here for us to get stimulus money to help us, you know, in these hard times, right out the window. And we go back to that cognitive dissonance and that denial, and people that voted this new administration in are, some of them are starting to say, okay, they're both the same.
But it's also a problem with two-party politics.
It's awful. It doesn't work.
You can't, well, you'll never get the truth.
Never.
You know, we have never. It here. I mean, we have multiple parties as you guys do, but obviously there are the main two leading parties. And you'll hear one side of the argument, and then when the other guy gets the chance to speak, it's so biased. The value of the discussion is lost because actually you're now not getting his take on the truth or his angle. What you're getting is his rebuttal, his attack on the other guy, and then the other guy is going to putting his attack back. And you never get the truth. You just
angle. Well, there's a very famous Native American wise man who said the right wing, the left wing are both the same bird. But like you said, you know, they're just attacking each other from different angles. And here we are stuck in the middle trying to figure out what the truth
trying
is.
Trying to figure
and
out the truth, exactly. Is,
neither one could be telling us the truth. You know, I always say there's three sides to every story. There's his side, that person's side, and then there's the actual truth, which is often lost in the argument. So, but yeah, once you see it, it's so hard to not see it. And it gets very depressing.
It is really, it really is.
It really does. And I'm a really cheerful, you know, kind of happy-go-lucky person. And, but I have, you know, times where it's like, I can't continue to write about this stuff. There's a few books. Originally, when I started, I never wanted to really write nonfiction. I probably shouldn't say that, but I wanted to be a novelist. But I started writing nonfiction a while ago, and it just really sort of took off. And I was, you know, getting continuous offers to write books. And one of the books that was presented by the publisher was 1111, The Time Prompt Phenomenon. And at the time, I was like, what? Huh? You know, and I wrote it with Larry Flaxman. I remember we called each other. We were like, what is 1111? And so we did some research and we thought, oh, okay. Yeah. And so we took the job of writing the book, and it really became this fascinating book about synchronicities, number synchronicities, and repeated patterns, and how the brain seeks out pattern and meaning in chaos or order out of chaos and all this stuff. But what was interesting is part of writing it, we wanted to talk to people and see if they actually had these 1111 sightings, you know, almost like they were UFOs. And we were so shocked by how many people, my agent, my book agent, Lisa, said, oh yeah, my mom used to go to 11/11 discussion parties back in the 1970s. And I'm like, what? I had never heard about it. But I had seen 333 all my life. And Larry had seen other, you know, I think his was 444. And once we started writing the book, we were seeing 11/11 everywhere. And I do think that that's, you know, a construct of the brain. But we talked to so many people that said that they had been seeing time prompts and that when they did, these amazing synchronicities would occur. And it started happening to me too. And what I realized is when you see something like that, if you see it once, no big deal. You see 11/11 twice, it's a coincidence. But when you start seeing it all the time, and it can be 12/12 or 5/5/5, whatever, you start to pay attention to the present moment, right? Oh my gosh, there it is again. Oh, there it is on that billboard, right? You're taken out of the worry about the future and the stressing over the past. You're in the present moment. And that's where you're able to have experiences of synchronicities that probably could be occurring all the time, but you're not available to them. And that was a really profound thing that came out of that book. And we wrote about it a little bit more in, another book called The Deja Vu Enigma. We talked a little bit more about that. And just really fascinating how all over the world, thousands, if not millions of people seeing 11/11. And to this day, still, you know, I get emails and messages. Oh my God, I think about you every time I see 11/11. You know, I saw it and somebody called me that I hadn't heard from in years and I was thinking about them, or I got the job that I wanted. And I really think that it is deeply involved with bringing us back into the present moment. You can't notice a synchronicity happening if you're stressing out about, you know, oh, geez, what happened last week on the job or something you have to do a week from now. But we found that people were just so brought into that immediacy of the present moment when they had a time prompt that then they stayed there and they noticed, you know, things that were always there. I kind of think that has a lot to do with people that see ghosts. They may be there all the time, right? But until you kind of shift into a different perspective or you shift your perception and you see one, you know, this stuff is just going on and you don't even notice. So it could be a matter of shifting consciousness, shifting perception. But when you have your synchronicities, when do they happen? When you personally, when do they happen?
So I have one that ties into you that I only realized the other day when I was doing some research for this. This is a multi-layered synchronicity, which is why it holds a little bit more. I had on the first season of my show, a wonderful guest, British guy, Gary Vasey, he's an occultist, written many, many books on all sorts of things, some his own, some stories he's gathered. He's got his own podcast as well, and multiple websites. Really kind of cool guy. And I'd been talking with him, about synchronicity. Mm-hmm. And it was at the time when I just watched Hellier. And I'd watched it all back to back.
Oh, yeah.
And so I'm watching Hellier, which is very, the topic of synchronicity comes up a lot. Then I'm talking with Gary Vasey and we're talking about synchronicity, and not in the context of Hellier, but just in general. And these things happen within the same week. Then I'm out walking my dog a few days later. And I'm going to withhold this name for you just for the mic drop at the end. I'm listening to Gary Vasey's own podcast and he has a guest on and they are talking in way more depth about the power of synchronicity and how the two of them have had a number of synchronicities happen since watching Hellier.
Yes.
And as I'm listening to their show, my phone beeps. I get an email back from Alan Greenfield saying that he's happy to come and talk to me, and he books in a time for me to have him on the show. So there's this kind of synchronicity around all that, that it all seemed to happen within a few days. How it then relates to you is that the guest that Gary Vasey had on his show that day was Anthony Peake, who indeed wrote the foreword to your book on synchronicities.
Yes. Oh,
that's kind of synchronicity on top of synchronicity. That it's hard to just ignore. And as something that Alan Greenfield said to me on that show, I put forward some example of something to him. And I said, it's hard to tell if it's a synchronicity or if it's just coincidence. And he said, but there is no such thing as coincidence.
No, there isn't. Yeah.
So it's
Carl Jung said coincidence is two events happening in the explicate external reality, but the cause happens on the implicate. It's hidden. So they're not coincidental. They're linked. They're connected. And it's so funny that you bring up Hellier, because the first time I saw I've seen it, the whole thing, three times. And the first time I watched it, same thing. Oh my heavens. Synchronicity after synchronicity. It was terrifying. I was kind of like, okay, this is really getting creepy here. And I was just so changed by it. And I kind of posted some stuff on Facebook because I like to get other people's, you know, see how they're feeling about things. And other people had started watching it. And so they were communicating back to me. Not only were they having synchronicities though, they were having synchronicities that led to me. And I was having synchronicities that led to other people that Alan had been on a friend's show. Oh gosh, his name just completely went out of my head. Olav Phillips. And he was pushing Alan's book on the Chrononauts, or not Chrononauts. What is,
yeah. Secret cipher of the Euphonauts.
And I was like, oh my God, you know, I have to read that. And out of the blue, Olav messaged me on Facebook and he said, hey, you know, I have a PDF of it. You want it? I was like, are you kidding? I've been thinking about that for days. And it's just like this little cobweb appears where you're linked to him and he's linked to her. And it's all like this. And it happened again the second time I watched it too. And I don't know what it is about that show. But I don't know if it was the timing of when it was released or just what, but a lot of the subject matter that they got into, whether it was the dumbs, the deep underground military bases and, you know, things going on in tunnels and what really are aliens or this or that, or the green men and all this stuff was all stuff that I had been looking into for other projects at the time. So I was like, yeah. But it had a profound effect on a lot of people that watched it.
But it's actually mentioned in the show. It might even be Alan himself who says part of the nature of the ritual of what those guys were going through extends beyond the small team and into anybody who witnesses it.
Yeah.
And by extension, therefore, the viewer.
I don't know. Well, I don't know how to explain that. But it did. And it did for, you know, a lot of people. I wasn't just going crazy. And I was almost afraid to read the cipher, the book, because I thought, okay, you know, I write about all this stuff, but I'm a big chicken. It's like, I don't want too weird of stuff to happen. But I started reading it. It was absolutely fascinating. And I don't know if they open a doorway. You know, I've heard that said a lot with people in the paranormal, the crypto field, and just that when a doorway is opened, it doesn't just affect the people that are opening the door. It's going to affect everybody. And the synchronicities kind of branch out, like I said, like that little cobweb. But it was really I think at the time I had been in the hospital and I had just gotten out, and I was watching it as a way to sort of, you know, just pass the time. And it was like, this is really deep. This is more than just a bunch of people running around looking for ghosts or goblins or whatever. There was something you could feel going on underneath that was so much bigger.
For me, I would say it's one of the landmark, certainly personally, one of the most groundbreaking realizations, revelations that I've had. I mean, I wasn't around when George Knapp released The Skinwalker, and you know, there have been other big bombshell moments of kind of wide realization. But for me, Hellier blew the roof off it.
I hope they do another season, because I there's so many unanswered questions. But you're right. I mean, it was one of those, you know, whether you want to use the umbrella term paranormal, it was one of those defining moment kind of series. And I just remember wanting to scream it from the rooftops for everybody to watch it. And a lot of people did. And they were just as affected as I was. I'm curious to see if I watch it now, what'll happen, if maybe that door is, you know, closed or, but yeah, that's really funny. Anthony Peake. Wow. Yep. That's interesting. Okay, so getting back to mind wars, one of the things that I wrote about that I was just so obsessed with was V2K, voice to skull, which is a technology whereby someone can use the microwave frequencies or field to project words, music, sounds, phrases into the mind of another person who could be miles away via, you know, some remote control or whatever. So voice to skull. And it was patented back in the 1970s. It's a real technology. While I was writing Mind Wars, I started to hear conversations in my head. And, you know, I went to the doctor twice thinking, oh my God, something's wrong, you know, maybe I'm going crazy. And, you know, I was fine. I thought maybe it was coming from my neighbor's apartment, but the apartment on the side of me at the time was vacant. The people below me, that was not their voices. Then I would start to hear music and I would hear clicks and all kinds of stuff. And it happened for the duration of me writing the chapter on V2K and targeted individuals who had had the same experiences. And I started to get emails from people who somehow knew that I was writing about V2K and targeted individuals when I had not even released, the book hadn't been released yet. So it lasted for about 3 or 4 months. And then I moved with my son. We're down in the same general area, but we were on top of the golf course. Now we're on the golf course and it stopped. So years later, I was doing a radio show and it was a host that I knew really well. And he said, oh, I've heard that before. I've heard people that, you know, were researching this or that technology actually have it happen to them as if, and he said, were you doing searches on the internet? I said, well, yeah. And it's like, somehow they know. And somebody was either trying to scare me or freak me out. But it was really, really frightening and also really, really interesting because I was able to actually say, this is real, okay? I'm not schizophrenic. I wasn't hearing my neighbors. I was experiencing the clicks. It sounded like Morse code. And I'm a ham radio operator. I know what Morse code is. And it sounded similar to that, the clicks and then pulses and beats and phrases and words and conversations, and always just distant enough that I couldn't make out what they were saying. When I was working with Mutual UFO Network years and years ago, I was heavily involved with the abduction phenomenon. This was the very beginning of abductees starting to come forward and ask for help. And I started getting phone calls, and the voice on the other end had been altered. It sounded like a robot, very robotic. It was a male voice. And this person would tell me what I had on, what book was laying on my bed in the bedroom, what rooms I was walking into, what I had just eaten and put back in the refrigerator, right? So I started closing my blinds and everything. And it kept happening. Got to the point where it was so harrowing. And this was before caller ID. I'm in my 50s. This was, you know, back in the dinosaur days. And I remember I was married at the time. I told my husband, he was like, you know, you really need to get out of the UFO thing before something bad happens. And I was like, no, I'm not going to be threatened or intimidated. Well, it got to the point where this person started getting into really personal things that had happened to me in my past that nobody else knew, nobody except me. And that is when I walked away from the UFO field completely for about 10 years before I got back in writing books. So yeah, I get those really interesting, you know, things that happen. I don't have like a ghost that appears or abducted by aliens, but just weird.
Way scarier. Maybe not than being abducted by aliens, but that's
it was terrifying. And years later, Nick Redfern, who is a writer, has written tons of books on UFOs and government cover-ups. You know, he and I were talking and he said, have you ever had a Men in Black experience? I'm writing a book. And I said, well, no, but I don't know, this thing happened to me. And he goes, oh my God, Marie, that's a Men in Black experience that I have heard of before. So he ended up writing about it in one of his books. Yeah, it was because I'm not intimidated easily. I'm a pretty, you know, tough New York Italian. But it was terrifying when someone is literally telling you things that nobody should know about. And you don't know, you know, have they bugged my apartment and my phone? And it was very creepy. So between that and the V2K, you think I would stop, but.
And also, I mean, I'm not even going to actually ask you. I'm going to hypothetically just say it. Who are they anyway? You know, you said they bugged the apartment. I mean, let's it's a conversation for another day, but.
I don't know.
Yeah, well, exactly.
People that wanted me, because I said at the time, our MUFON group was being approached. This was in the 1990s and abductees were just starting to come forward. And so it was before all the big media hype with, oh, UFO abductions. And we had some really interesting people coming to us asking for help and we didn't know what to do with them. And I really kind of think that maybe that was a way to say, back off.
Yeah, sure.
I had run the MUFON group with another woman named Laura. I won't say her last name. And I will tell you that what happened to her was so bad that she and her husband packed up their home and moved to another state. So I didn't get the heavy duty brunt of it, but yeah.
We're back to mind control again, aren't we?
Yeah. And it worked on me at the time, even though later I was like, what? It's like, I'm going to start writing about this stuff again. And nothing like that has happened since, because so many books, I mean, so much has come out that there's nothing I could really do or say that hasn't already been put out there. But I think at the time there were people that did not want the abduction phenomenon to be talked about or kind of put out there for whatever reasons.
Yeah, well, because they know and they don't want people to know that they know.
Yeah, I mean, you know, one of the things I thought at the time is, are they behind it? Is this like a psyop, you know, psychological experiment? Or is the government doing this to psychologically mess with people? And I don't know, but it was terrifying. When you realize that somebody is watching you, that's, you know, stalking to the extreme.
That psychological element, I mean, as I say, I ask all the guests to give me a scary story, and they can be everything from I saw a Bigfoot to, you know, I saw lights in the sky. The mm-hmm. psychological element in your own home, in the sanctity of your oh. own four walls, that psychological thing's way scarier for me.
We ended up moving, and it didn't happen after that. As soon as I left the group, it stopped. So they got what they wanted, but it didn't stop the phenomenon from exploding anyway. So it's like, you know, hey, too bad. But yeah, I would love to see Bigfoot. I really would. That would not be scary. As long as it's from a distance, you know?
I'm a really... I sit on the fence because I've never really had any profound... I've seen what I would regard as UFO lights in the sky, but at night when they're lights, and I've seen them move in ways right. that it has to be... To me, it's a UFO. Thought I saw a ghost once. No profound... And so I'm in a position where I'd love to see a ghost. I'd love to see one. I'd love to see a UFO. I'd love to see a Bigfoot. I don't want to push my luck. Yes, I do want to know. I do want to just step off the edge once. But at the same time, I don't want to bring that shit in into my house. Right. And
the way that it would affect your family. And it's funny though, with children, my son, when he's 19 now, but when he was small, he would see things and say things that were like, what? And I remember reading that, you know, children, their brain waves are usually an alpha. And I think theta when they're really young. And so their consciousness is a little bit altered compared to an adult's waking state. And I always wondered, maybe they're really seeing what we as adults have somehow blocked out our ability to perceive. Yeah. But I had those same feelings when my son was young and I was writing about all this stuff. I used to feel like, oh man, you know, I really want to see a UFO. And then I would kind of stop and go, okay, well, way over there.
Yeah.
Don't come in the backyard, just way over there. Because you think about the more frightening aspects of it. And it's not just you anymore. But even if it was just me, yeah, I am a big chicken. I never got into the ghost hunting thing much. It was like, oh, no.
And it's one thing that, you know, I'd love to see a Bigfoot. But what if, I don't know where your home is. Like, we're relatively rural here. What if I was out in the garden with a dog one night and I saw right. it behind my garden shed? Then I'd have to move house. So exactly. I don't wish that. You know, I don't wish
you don't
it was
know
here.
Friendly like, Bigfoot or not friendly Bigfoot?
Yeah.
On a golf course, and we have this big round putting area, and I'm like, oh man, I know one night I'm gonna come in here to get some tea, and there's gonna be a UFO landing on that thing. I mean, it's like Viking. So it's like we want so badly to have these experiences, but then it's like, well, you know, how would it affect your life from that point on? Bigfoot, like if you're, you know, somewhere else, but not in your own home area.
But also as we've been discussing, and certainly as you've written on in way more detail, if as is often prophesied, these things are all in some way linked. And that perhaps the UFO aspect might be something more supernatural. Perhaps Bigfoot himself is an alien. But all the wild theories. But there is maybe the little thread that runs through them all. That seeing something in the sky might not be an extraterrestrial metal craft from another planet. That could be something else.
Interdimensional or projection of our own consciousness. Yeah. Or who knows. Yeah.
And so,
not that... Actually, explanation.
Best to just keep a step back, I think.
We'll just talk and write about it. We don't actually have to see it.
Yeah, exactly.
So, well, people can find me at mariedjones.com and all over social media. Marie D. Jones, Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, blah, blah, blah. I think I'm on Telegram. Nonfiction, I'm writing a natural health manual and then a book on the afterlife and then a big UFO book that looks at the personal side, what happens to people, not just the nuts and bolts, what they saw, but how it changed their lives. Those will be coming out next year. This year in May, I have Propaganda and Disinformation coming out, and then the Toxin Nation, the systematic poisoning of our air, water, food, and bodies coming at the end of the year. And I am getting ready to launch a massive fiction conspiracy thriller book series called Black Mariah. And it is with 8 other writers from all over the world. It's a shared, kind of a shared universe. Everybody writes from their point of view in their country. That's going to be launched in the summer. So I'm really excited about that. That's all the conspiracy stuff I get to, like, you know, in fiction, you get to just let loose with. So that's going to be a blast.
Awesome. Wow. Can't wait. Cool. So Marie, thank you so much for joining us. It has been an absolute joy to speak with you and to hear a little bit about your work. We've got much more to discuss another day, I'm sure.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. I look forward to coming back.
Peer Beyond the Veil has been written and presented by myself, Mark Watson, as part of the Fearscape Media Network. Music and soundtracks are credited and licensed to Purple Planet and to Kevin MacLeod, licensed under Creative Commons. All rights are reserved by our parent company, MLW Publishing. You can follow us at facebook.com/peerbeyondtheveil or on Twitter at peerbeyondtheveil or at peerbeyond2020. Please click the like and subscribe buttons when you see them. Most importantly, wherever you listen to your podcasts. It helps us to attract the attention we need to keep the show going, to get the guests that you all want to hear from, and to help more and more people